Oh, you can't talk for long with people involved in school sports before somebody mentions Title IX. That law revolutionized American sports, forcing schools to spend as much on girls' sports as on boys. It's estimated now that more than 3 million girls play sports at the high school level alone. Yet even with all the changes, an advocacy group contends that some schools do not follow the law. NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
The National Women's Law Center filed complaints yesterday against 12 school districts, including New York City and Chicago, as well as districts in Georgia, South Dakota, California. According to data provided by the districts, there are double-digit gaps between the percentage of girls enrolled and the lower percentage of girls playing sports. Title IX says the numbers are supposed to be about the same. Nina Chaudhry is senior counsel for the National Women's Law Center.
These numbers are so stark and the gaps are so big that it shows that they have a lot of, you know, explaining to do.
The Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights will investigate the complaints. When reached yesterday, some of the districts said they'll work to remedy the problems, but they didn't like that the center based its complaints on figures from 2006, the most recent available numbers. Sue Simons is with the Sioux Falls, South Dakota School District.
Those are old numbers, 4 years ago. We know for a fact that those numbers are not what they are today.
She says since 2006, the district has added two girls' sports, competitive dance and competitive cheerleading. And if an OCR investigation requires adding even more,
it would be very difficult based upon the funding of education, particularly in South Dakota.
It's a significant issue outside of South Dakota. How do you add sports programs in a down economy that's forcing many districts to cut teachers and education programs? Critics worry it'll mean cutting boys' sports to get numbers more even. National Women's Law Center co-president Marcia Greenberger says it doesn't have to happen if districts ask the following.
Have you looked to your parent body? Have you looked to the community? Have you looked to what kinds of volunteer services and help you might be able to engage?
Have you, in short, found your Dennis Albert?
My daughter started skating way back when she was 3 and a half, and then we've been into hockey for the last 10, 12 years.
Dennis Albert is from Presque Isle, Maine, up near the Canadian border. His daughter Hillary played hockey with the boys up until high school. She was very good, but too small to make the boys' team. There wasn't a girls' team. Dennis went to the school superintendent, who said a girls' team would cost $150,000. Dennis and his wife went to work, selling jewelry, collecting bottles, holding an auction supper. After 3 years,
we raised $23,000, so we're a big step away.
Probably too big to help Hillary, who's now a 17-year-old junior. But Dennis says he'll keep going. He says it hurt Hillary's self-esteem not to make the boys' team, and he doesn't want to see that with other local girls eager to compete in high school.
They should be able to play, and eventually they will play. We just got to row down that budget that he wants, hopefully, or hopefully they can realize that the girls want to play.
Presque Isle wasn't in one of yesterday's targeted districts, but in the minds of Title IX proponents, it's as good an example as anywhere that a law that's brought so much change still has a ways to go. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. For homeowners looking to refinance, there's good news and bad news. First, the good. Mortgage rates are at historic lows. The bad news is most Americans can't take advantage of them. Either their credit scores aren't perfect, they've lost income, or their houses have lost value. So tens of millions of Americans have been effectively blocked from saving hundreds of dollars a month by refinancing. Today, NPR's Chris Arnold has the second of two stories on a proposal to change that.
Terry Riccio runs a pet taxi service in Boston. For around $50 round trip, she'll take, say, an elderly person's dog to the vet. She'll even pick up turtles and snakes. But getting her hands around today's low interest rates is proving to be an even slipperier task.
Even though I make enough to pay my mortgage, the banks won't even look at me because it's a lot more strict than it was in the past.
We spoke to Riccio at a home ownership event at a convention center in Boston. Riccio says if she could qualify for today's low rates, down well below 4.5%, that would save her $450 a month on her mortgage, which would be a big help right now.
Definitely would help me, and I also think it would help a number of people. Right now, the market today was 4.35. why not just give everybody 4.35 and we would avoid more foreclosures, people would be happier, and I think the economy would get a lot better.
And that's basically what some economists are proposing, at least for some 30 million Americans. The idea is that because of the financial crisis, the federal government has ended up guaranteeing 60% of all the existing home mortgages in the country. So since the government's on the hook anyway, allowing all those people to refinance at today's low rates would make defaults less likely and save homeowners money.
You'd be giving what amounts to a tax cut for the life of the mortgage.
That's Glenn Hubbard, an economist at Columbia University who helped to come up with this proposal. He says that extra spending money would help to stimulate the economy.
As much as a few thousand dollars per year for many, many years, that has a very big effect.
Hubbard says it would add up to around $50 billion a year. So what are the plan's political prospects? Well, Glenn Hubbard is the former chief economic advisor to President George W. Bush. So the plan is being pushed by a Republican, and some 30 Democrats in Congress have already co-sponsored a bill to make this happen. So could this be something Republicans and Democrats could actually agree on? Glenn Hubbard.
I think it might. Both parties will obviously be focused on the economy and jobs and things that can be done. The real question is whether there'll be any stimulus bill at all. But if there is one, I would expect this to be part of it.
Also, Hubbard says the plan wouldn't cost taxpayers any money. It would just let more people qualify for interest rates that are available in the market. But the plan does have its critics.
I think this will end up not working.
Anthony Sanders is a finance professor at George Mason University. He says the plan exaggerates the savings to homeowners, underestimates the costs, and the barriers to making this work. Banks might throw up roadblocks, insurance companies might not go along, and the biggest problem...
I'm very scared by the notion that we're going to go through and just for millions of households give them a savings of $300 to $500 a month. Because that's not free. It comes out of somebody's pocket.
That $50 billion for homeowners will come out of investors' pockets. For example, community banks have mortgage holdings that could take a hit. And some speculators around the world have made bets that so many loans wouldn't be able to refinance into better rates.
Those investors are going to lose out based on that refinancing.
Tom Deutsch is the executive director of the American Securitization Forum, which represents some mortgage investors. He says, though, his members are actually split. Some don't like this idea, but others think it might help the overall market enough that it's worth it.
There is some division within the investment community as to whether this would be an appropriate program and would be in their best interests.
A senior official says the Treasury Department is, quote, continuing to refine the administration's housing policies. Some economists think a likely next move for the government would be to launch a scaled-down version of the plan. Chris Mayer and Glenn Hubbard say as long as it's not too scaled down, many more Americans could be saving hundreds of dollars a month on their home loans. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
The odds are not good for legislation on climate change to get through Congress anytime soon. Still, environmental regulators are moving forward with new rules. For the first time, the Environmental Protection Agency has issued instructions for states to regulate emissions from power plants and other large industrial polluters. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren has more.
Starting next year, companies would need greenhouse gas permits when building or expanding power plants, refineries, metal smelters, cement kilns, or other major polluters. The EPA says at the beginning, instead of being required to install expensive, cutting-edge technologies, companies will have to use the most efficient, cost-effective equipment available. By using less fuel, they'll produce less greenhouse gas pollution. But lawyer Jeffrey Homestead, who represents businesses covered by the regulations, says they're so unclear that neither businesses nor regulators will know what to do.
It's going to be a mess. There basically will be a construction ban on industrial construction for a couple of years.
Gina McCarthy, who heads the EPA's air pollution programs, rejects that.
The Clean Air Act for 40 years has found a way to issue permits in a way that's allowed the economy to continue to grow, allowed new facilities, new companies, and new jobs. We are not going to stop that with the greenhouse gas process.
Some states and businesses are challenging the agency in court. Attempts by congressional opponents to stall the EPA program failed this year. But with Republicans taking control of the House and more Republicans in the Senate, the EPA's rule is a likely target of the new Congress. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.
And our last word in business today comes from Google. According to several business media, the internet giant is giving pay raises to employees to try and stop them from defecting to other tech companies, including rivals like Facebook. The 10% pay raise is nice for Google's 23,000 workers, all of them except one. And the last word today is you're fired. Google did not take kindly to its pay raise being made public, so according to Fortune magazine, the internet giant has terminated the employee who allegedly leaked the news of the pay raises to the media. And that's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
On Sunday, a new reality show debuts on TLC, Sarah Palin's Alaska. Republican strategist Karl Rove questioned whether a reality show could make Palin look more presidential, but commentator Andrew Wallenstein says the point here isn't presidential. Not exactly.
If Sarah Palin wanted to supply ammo to her enemies, her reality show, it's like handing them a cannon. But if she runs for president, Sarah Palin's Alaska will be looked back on as a brilliant move. It's not a great TV show. It's really just a nature documentary mixed with footage of her day-to-day family life. And when you live in Alaska, life just happens to involve navigating treacherous terrain.
So girls, when you cast, don't aim towards the bear, okay?
Why?
Because if you hook the bear, he would get ticked off.
Yeah. The show offers nothing on her qualifications for higher office, which is precisely what makes it a shrewd marketing strategy. Sarah Palin's Alaska is just another example of politicians going a little farther out on a cultural limb than you might presume they would to promote themselves. Think Bill Clinton playing the saxophone on Arsenio Hall's show, or more recently, Barack Obama appearing on The View.
And I'm going to do a little lightning rod, so you just give me your first impressions, okay?
Let's go.
Do you know that Lindsay Lohan is in jail?
I did.
Now, it may sound so tawdry to say, Sarah Palin going on a reality show. But reality show is the most meaningless term in the television business. The unscripted genre is really like eight different kinds of shows. It makes no sense to compare Sarah Palin's Alaska with John and Kate Plus Eight or Dancing with the Stars. Oh, wait, Palin's daughter Bristol's on that show.
Dancing the Quickstep, Bristol Palin and her partner Mark Ballas.
When some people hear reality show, they presume they're getting an all-access pass to somebody's life. And that may be true for average Joes who sign their lives away to be on these shows, but not someone of Palin's stature. And so the truth is, what you're going to see on this show won't really be the truth. What it will be is a carefully choreographed projection of the kind of life Palin wants you to think she leads. And should any unguarded, unflattering moments have occurred while filming, trust me, she won't allow them to air. Which isn't to say Sarah Palin's Alaska is completely sanitized. You'll see her overdosing on her BlackBerry and scolding her kids, and that's smart. If she seemed like some kind of superwoman, it would ring false even to Palin's most devoted followers. Now, if her detractors finally relate to her in a whole new way, well, then going on reality TV will have really paid off.
Andrew Wallenstein is the senior editor at Paid Content.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
People who know nothing else about rugby may know something about the 1995 Rugby World Cup. It was the subject of the movie Invictus. It was played in South Africa, the first major sporting event there after the end of apartheid. Nelson Mandela, South Africa's first black president, embraced his country's national team, known as the Springboks, even though rugby was the game of South Africa's white minority. Blacks prefer soccer. The Springboks had been barred from international rugby under anti-apartheid sanctions, and now they were playing New Zealand in the final game for the World Cup in their own country. The score was tied, they were in overtime, and a South African player drop-kicked a goal to win it. And the player who scored that goal is in Washington today to receive an award from the Search for Common Ground. He's Joel Stransky. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much, Robert. Nice to be here.
And for people who remember the movie, we should say you were played by Scott Eastwood, the son of Clint Eastwood. You're not the Matt Damon character.
No, that would have been Francois Pienaar, the captain and the forward.
How important to South Africa was that World Cup in 1995?
Well, I think it was a special time for us in our country. In some ways, a time of uncertainty. You know, we were a very young democracy and a new president, our first black president. And we were a nation still divided, really. And I think that World Cup came at a time for us where it just helped in some little way unite a country around a sports team.
The Common Ground Awards recognize accomplishments in conflict resolution, negotiation, community, and peace building, not sports. During that World Cup, did you feel that you had the burden of those very weighty achievements on your back, or were you playing rugby?
We were playing rugby. We were just a bunch of young sportsmen wanting to get out on the field and do the best we could. But we had a common goal, and we had a little slogan that we try to live by, and that was one team, one country. And I think as that World Cup progressed, we could see the demographic breakdown of the supporters changing around us and obviously a country uniting around this team.
You could see that it was no longer just whites there cheering you on in the stands.
We could, absolutely. And I think it was partially the fact that we were doing quite well and we were winning. But I think most importantly, it was Nelson Mandela's support of the team that ensured that everyone supported the team.
I've read that it was a turning point for you to make the trip that many visitors to South Africa make, I did, to Robben Island to see the prison and even the cell where Nelson Mandela had spent so many years.
Well, I think, you know, you've been there and you've seen that cell. It is the smallest, tiniest little room that you can imagine with nothing in it, with a bucket and a steel bed. And to imagine a man sacrificing so many years of his life for what he believed, you know, you can only love and adore the man.
In the racial and ethnic mix of South Africa, you are a member of a minority within a minority. You're a South African Jew.
Yeah.
And I gather people think of you as a South African Jewish player. That figures in your identity.
Yeah, they do. And there's some wonderful legacies in South Africa about the Springbok team needing a Jew to do well. So it also helps my legendary status, I suppose.
Oh, is that true? It's considered good luck for the team?
It is considered good luck, yeah.
Do you see any opportunities today in the world for people in sports to do things that might indeed ease larger tensions and contribute to peace and community?
Absolutely. I think sport is a fantastic conduit. And if I think about in our country, how many different organizations use sport to unite children at a level, use it as upliftment, trying to, you know, get the gangsters out of the gangster territories, use sport to get them back into schools and into a better lifestyle. So I think sport is a wonderful conduit.
Joel Stransky, congratulations on the award that you're receiving, and nice to talk with you.
Thank you for having me. Nice to be here.
Joel Stransky kicked the winning goal for South Africa in the 1995 Rugby World Cup. The team and that competition were featured in the movie Invictus. Stransky is in Washington to accept an award on behalf of that year's entire team from the Search for Common Ground. The award is for inspiring unity and healing through the power of sports.
You're listening to All Things Considered.